news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait, there's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Welcome to a very special episode of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, episode number 128. In this episode, we're going to be focusing on three films that recently played at the Fantasia International Film Festival in Montreal, Quebec. We're going to be looking at The Unseen, Bed of the Dead, and Some Freaks. From The Unseen, I'll be talking to writer-director Jeff Redknapp. From Bed of the Dead, I'm talking to co-writer and director Jeff Mahar, co-writer and producer Cody Callahan, actor Colin Price, and co-producers Chad Archibald and Christopher Giroux. And from Some Freaks, I'll be talking to writer-director Ian McAllister McDonald and actress Lily Mae Harrington. Enjoy.
Now we're talking The Unseen, and this is a film that's written and directed by Jeff Redknapp, and it's Jeff's debut feature, premiering at Fantasia Fest in Montreal on July 17th. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hi. Happy to be here.
And congratulations on The Unseen. I've seen it, and it's fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Many are calling it a must-see at Fantasia, and I can certainly attest to that.
Cool. We are thrilled with the initial response. Feels really nice to start out with this kind of response.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because whenever I have the opportunity to see a film that's going to be playing at a festival or a festival film, I like to go into it as cold as possible. In other words, I try not to read the synopsis. I try not to really know much about the plot because for two reasons. Number one, because I don't want to build up expectations. And number two, when it comes to film festivals, I really like to that sense of discovery. I really like to be surprised. So when I started watching your film, I really didn't know much of what it was about or what to expect. And it sort of started in one way, and then it took me somewhere else. And at the end of it all, I just thought, wow, that was something really, really incredible.
Wow, again, thank you. Incredible is a strong word.
Now, do you want to perhaps describe a little bit of the plot of The Unseen?
Yeah, I could try. I haven't pitched the story in a little while, but The Unseen is the story of Bob Langmore, who is a retired hockey player, and he works in a small town sawmill. And as the story progresses, you discover that he had a wife and a young daughter, and he effectively abandoned them and moved away, and has distanced himself entirely from them in every sense except financial support. And he's just scraping by, and then you discover that the reason he estranged himself from his loved ones is that he has a mysterious condition where he is gradually becoming invisible.
Mm-hmm. And going into the movie and at the beginning, sort of like very, very rural, pastoral, winter, very Canadian.
He didn't shy away from the Canadian. We made him a hockey player.
For sure. And he was a hockey player. He said A quite a few times.
Yeah.
Kelowna, BC, is that where you set the film?
Yeah, we shot it in a few locations. Kelowna, Vernon, mm-hmm. and Langley, which is just outside of Vancouver.
So when he starts leaving the mill and heading to see his daughter, and you know the whole invisibility thing starts coming into the picture, I didn't see it coming, and the movie just went to a very unexpected direction for me. I mean, at the end of it all, it was dramatic, funny, sad, but with some horror, some sci-fi, and really just very touching. And I get the sense, I mean, you wrote the film as well, there's something that seems very personal about it. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah. I'm not sure what exactly you thought was personal. If it's too personal, I probably won't tell you. But I grew up in small town BC, northern BC. I did a summer job in the sawmill. I worked in mining camp.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, you know, I do have roots in that small town blue collar labor based lifestyle where you're working yourself really hard, and you work in winter and summer, and mm-hmm. it's always too hot or too cold, and you know, basically, and working in the film industry now, you know, you go to work some days and you're wearing, you know, more layers of warm clothing than anybody should need to wear when they're doing a job, but that's the nature of it. But yeah, personal, I grew up in a small town. I spent some time in sawmills. I have one of my oldest closest friends is still back in, well, no, actually, he just relocated, but he's still up in northern BC. He's a millwright in sawmills. He was a bit of a model for the character of Bob, and the stories he told me about his job definitely factored into the character and the mill scene.
Also, when I was saying personal, I was also kind of referring to the familial relationships in terms of Bob's relationship with his daughter, the disintegration of his family, and it's interesting, I mean, because on one hand you have the disintegration of his body as he's becoming more and more invisible, but it also deals with, you know, a disintegration and somewhat of a reconciliation of family. And that's why I found it to be really touching. And when I was looking at the title, The Unseen, I was almost thinking at the end of the movie, and this is where it was personal for me, because my relationship with my father was not a great one. And yet, you know, there are things that, of course, The Unseen can refer to the invisibility, but Bob has a daughter, Eva, that he abandoned, doesn't know much about her father, but there's still this sort of yearning for both of them to reconnect with one another. And I was almost thinking, like, The Unseen can also refer to the things that our parents do for us when we're young that we don't see, that we don't realize until we're sort of older, and then we do kind of appreciate what our parents actually did for us.
That's the beauty of a title like that. I mean, in the most literal sense, the title was inspired by H.G. Wells' The Invisible Man,
mm-hmm.
Because throughout that book, they refer to invisibility and the condition of invisibility and the invisible man as the unseen. Like, the expression appears, I think I did a search, and it's like 28 times or something in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used in different formats, like a different meaning every time, but then now that it's the title of our film and it's out in the world, I totally see what you're saying, that, you know, the family relationships and what people do for each other, and I guess in the context of our film, what Bob did to protect his family by leaving them could very well be seen as the unseen on his part.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that he did that they didn't understand, protecting them, they did not see it. So
exactly, and that's sort of where I felt, you know, that at the end of it all, why the film really sort of touched me. The actor that played Bob is Aidan Young. Complete wonderful performance. He was very, very intense, you know, a very formidable presence. A very sort of laconic person at the very beginning, but then very multifaceted, you know, with very minimal sort of acting. The different layers of him sort of expose itself as the film goes on, and you realize there's so much more to this man than what you're introduced to at the very beginning of the film. And I wonder how you found Aidan, or how you went about casting him.
It was kind of just perfect timing in that I had written the film. I had some ideas about casting. And then when we first got into production, we started working with a casting director I work with, Judy Lee. And she, you know, she said that, you know, I've looked at your suggestions and there's lots of really, you know, strong local actors and we can definitely pursue them. And then she said, but you know what? You have a little bit of time. You're not in such a rush that you can't think could make this film great, and maybe you're not sure you're going to get them, but you have time to try. And when she said that, I thought, well, here's the thing. I saw Rectify a couple months prior to that. I had just discovered it. My producer, Katie Weekly, I found this show on Netflix. You've got to watch it. And I was like, oh, okay. So I watched the first episode, and as soon as the credits rolled, I was on IMDb finding out who Aidan Young was, because I couldn't believe I'd never seen him before or didn't know that name. And then when I found him, it was like, oh, yeah, okay, I've seen him he's that guy, you know, he's a chameleon, okay. And then he was in that other thing, and I saw that. And then, okay, he's in Black Rope, which is like an iconic Canadian film where he was a teenager in his first big role. And lo and behold, I discovered he was Canadian, which is a key factor in making low-budget Canadian films, because it really helps with the telephone connection and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that, you know, that all flowed through my head when Judy was saying, is there anyone you want to reach out to? And I said, well, there's this guy I just discovered. His name's Aidan Young, and he's Canadian. And, you know, I later discovered that Rectified is known as the best show on television that nobody's watching. And I don't know if you've seen it, but it is brilliant.
I haven't seen it, so...
It is amazing, and everyone should go watch it, because he's so good in it, and the show is so good, and it has such an original voice. But anyway, yeah, so I threw that at Judy, and I said, you know, can we go after him? And she was like, well, I guess so, let me check. And she looked, and she said, oh, you know what, I know his Canadian management, let me reach out to him. So she, you know, I'm going to ramble here, but she did. She contacted him and checked on his availability, and he, you know, he said he looked at the script, and we got a script to him, and, you know, he's a busy guy. He's always doing something, always going somewhere. And I think we caught him right when he was relocating his family back to Australia, because he had, you know, born in Canada, moved to Australia as a kid, and most of his childhood there. And then he'd moved around since for work. And at this point, he was moving back to Australia. So he's basically taking time to, talk to us on Skype and stop unpacking boxes and whatnot. But, you know, we got to talking on Skype, and he said there was a very personal connection to the character that he liked, you know, and there was serendipity because he said he plays hockey. And, you know, there's a hockey card in the movie, which was actually a photo of him playing hockey.
Cause
he does it recreationally now. And just he took to the thing, to the material, and then he, then it came down to his scheduling, and we said, okay, well, what have you got? And he said, I have to be back on Rectify in mid-February or early March, I think it was that year. And we said, okay, well, we will put it together and make it work so that you can do our show and get back to Rectify without any problem. And so then he said, yeah.
How long was the production?
I think we shot for 21 days. Later on, we shot two more days, much later. That involved the bears.
I mean, the cast is uniformly strong. I mean, in addition to Aidan, Ben Cotton as Grisby is wonderful. Camille Sullivan is wonderful. Julia Sarah Stone as Bob's daughter Eva is wonderful. And the bears are wonderful. And unlike the Revenant, yeah, they were real bears.
Yeah. We hired bears. And they were the bears that were in Borat.
Oh.
So those bears, probably just one of them, because when you have two bears, they, on set, one of them will take to doing something and the other one might not. So I forget which one. I think it was Chester. He was the bear hanging out of the ice cream truck in Borat.
Huh.
So he was a celebrity.
He was a celebrity bear, yeah?
Yeah, celebrity bear. He had to have his Krispy Kremes and all that.
Did he have an entourage?
He had a team of, I believe, three trainers. It was a pretty big deal having bears on set.
Besides the really strong script and the really superb performances, another thing that really sticks out in The Unseen is the effects. You, I mean, this is your debut feature film, but you've been doing makeup for special effects makeup for quite a while.
Yes, my first professional makeup effect job was on the original X-Files series in Vancouver, season 3.
And you've worked on Deadpool, Cabin in the Woods, The Watchmen, the upcoming Star Trek Beyond, Final Destination, X-Men Origins Wolverine. Can you speak about your makeup career for a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been very fortunate. You know, I had a lucky break where I started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I literally had a friend who knew Gillian Anderson's husband at the time, and mean, I was young, and I was like, I don't even know if I have what it, you know, the skills required to do this professionally. And, you know, I went down for an interview, and I saw what they were doing, and they saw what I'd been doing. And a week later, I got a call and said, yeah, we're really busy, come help. And so I jumped into the trenches and learned a whole lot of stuff on the X-Files. And coincidentally, when we came around to making The Unseen all these years later, Toby was the first person I went to talk about helping out with the makeup effects on the film.
Mm-hmm. Were you hands-on with the makeup at all on The Unseen?
No. It would have broken me, I think. Mm-hmm. I wore a lot of hats on that show, and you know, I surrounded myself with amazing artists that could handle all the makeup effects. I was a little bit hands-on with the puppeteering of the Bob puppet.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, nope, Sarah Graham headed up the makeup department. She's experienced in makeup effects, heading shows. And so she ran the department. Toby handled the more extreme prosthetic looks on Aiden with some of his crew, Matt Abick. And then Toby had his whole shop building the pieces. And then there was the animatronic side of it, which was a new company called Amazing Ape, run by Werner Pretorius and Richard Darwin. They came out and they built insane life-size puppet of Bob, which was the practical side of the Bob effect,
mm-hmm.
along with the makeup effect. And then, of course, we had the digital element, which was Encore Vancouver, Bob Habros, and Adele Venable. And, it was 20 years of working in film in Vancouver, reaching out to all the people that I knew could put this together and make it work.
Well, I have to say the invisibility effects are stunning. I mean, this is not your Claude Rains Invisible Man. I mean, this is something else. I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's just the way Bob starts to disappear. It's something unique and very seamless. I mean, you really can't tell where the prosthetics end and the CG begins. Just wonderful work.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, this is a pretty amazing experience right now because. You're one of the first people that's seen it and given us feedback on it. So there's all these aspects of the film that we've just like, you know, we did the best we could and we think it's awesome and we hope everyone else thinks it's awesome. And you put it out there, you give birth to it and put it in the world and you don't know how people are going to respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to hear that the effects side of it is as strong as it is, it's very rewarding for everybody involved.
Now, you did mention when you started doing makeup when you were 12. Who were some of your influences?
Well, the first thing that happened, the story I tell, the first thing that happened is my older brother found a book in the library, a high school library. I don't know why, small town BC high school library had a book on how to make prosthetic makeup. It was a very technical book about the mold making, called Lee Bagan's Techniques of Three-Dimensional Makeup, and it just happened to be in this, our high school library. My older brother found it, brought it home. He was interested in it for about 3 weeks and then lost interest. And I literally picked the book up and never looked back. So I spent years trying to figure out how to do these things. Tom Savini put out a book right around that time that showed a whole other side of makeup effects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't the textbook, you know, step by step, this is how you do things. It was a different approach. It was just like, makeup effects is magic, and you have to be ready to create something that doesn't exist. You have to make heads that explode and all sorts of, you know, he had a very outside-the-box thinking approach to makeup effects, and he put it in a book that my generation of makeup effects artists, you know, worship, you know. And you know, so at that time, makeup effects people, you know, Dick Smith, of course, Tom Savini, Rick Baker, Stan Winston, and I was growing up on all those aliens and ghosts and monsters. You know, it shaped my appreciation of the art of makeup effects and film.
The Unseen is your first feature film. It's not your first film. You've made a few short films beforehand. But who would you cite as some of your filmmaking influences?
Well, it's a challenging question because, you know, when you're a film buff, you have such a big arsenal of influences that you could go talk for hours. in the beginning, it was definitely, you know, John Carpenter, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, Coppola, you know, it was the early Carpenter film, Escape from New York, the thing, Halloween and Fog, those just, like, shaped me, and they still influence the way I approach my films. But, you know, I mean, I kind of, like most 12-year-olds, I started out in genre films, like Jaws was the film that just opened my eyes to filmmaking. When I wanted to, you know, after I saw Jaws, I wanted to be a filmmaker. And then, you know, like a lot of young boys, I'm into the monsters and the horror and all that stuff. And then later, in my later teens, I started discovering Sergio Leone, you know, Akira Kurosawa, all the stuff everybody says, but it's true, you know. You open your eyes to the art of filmmaking, you know. You realize that this sequel to some horror franchise actually isn't a great movie, and there's so much more out there to see. So I think it's a natural growth process, you know. Mm-hmm. You just start watching great films as well as bloody, gory monster movies, and yeah, and so you just keep going. Lately, I'm very much right now into Jeff Nichols.
Okay.
And he was an influence in How We Made the Unseen. You know, the very real family drama side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, sort of low key. Like, I saw his latest film, Loving, and it's mind blowing how subdued it is. It's such a important subject, but it's told in such a low key, real way. Not the peaks and valleys of the high dramas that would be winning the best Oscar like 10-15 years ago. It's just a different beat.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Nichols, you know, his last couple films, Midnight Special, it's a total family drama with this bizarre sci-fi vein in it. And that was kind of something we were going for. I mean, I hadn't seen Midnight Special when we, you know, it came out after we finished The Unseen, but to see that he put out a film that had a similar tone, it was inspiring.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. I mean, and I mean this as a complete compliment. I mean, that's what The Unseen is. It's a low-key horror film. It's a family drama with elements of horror, with elements of sci-fi, but if you were to remove those elements from the movie, you'd still have an extremely effective, touching family drama.
Yeah, and that was part of the design, you know. I mean, filmmaking, I find, is a process of, you know, you set out, you plan something, you set out to do something every step of the way, you're trying to achieve something, and, you know, if it all comes into place, you can make a good film that you're happy with, but then the layer above that is what the magic that happens, you know. I think anyone who tries hard enough can make a good film, but to make a great film, the stars have to align, magic happens, lightning strikes, things come together that you never planned. You know, that was one of the things on The Unseen, you know, directing at this level, a feature film level, you know, it's a low-budget film, but, you know, working with the actors of this caliber, and especially Aiden, I mean, things were happening every day that I couldn't have planned. You know, just choices in the moment, and directions with the character, and, you know, you get chills sometimes watching what happened between action and cut, because it wasn't what you envisioned. You know, sometimes they say, you know, a director knows exactly what he wants, you know, and I believe that's important, but I also think that sometimes if you get exactly what you want, you don't get everything it could be. You have to be open to what it, you know, what can happen when you kind of just let it go. But the process of making a film, it is so all-consuming, and it's so, I mean, you know, we spent years from conception to completion of this film, and to now get to take it to Fantasia and sit in an audience with it and just see what people think and get their genuine emotional response to the film and the story and the characters, I'm excited about it.
Well, once again, I'm going to repeat. I mean, going into the film not knowing what to expect and viewing it, I thought I was stunned. I just thought it was quite brilliant. So I really feel that audiences will respond. What are your plans after Fantasia for The Unseen?
Well, we sort of have a rough plan of about a year of festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And that is still very much TBD right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have to wait. You know, we're in that period that we put it out to that first big wave of festivals, and, you know, Fantasia was the earliest in the cycle, and they were the first, and we don't honestly know what the second one is. We don't know what's next. We don't know what, but there's a lot of stuff in the fall that we're hopeful for. And then after that, I mean, based on some of the discussions we've had with sales agents and whatnot, the film will likely be released mid-2017.
I really do think it is a singular piece of work, and I want to congratulate you on making such an accomplished debut feature, and wish you the best of luck at Fantasia. It really is a tremendous film. So here at Fantasia Fest, we're talking Bed of the Dead, and I'm sitting here with the director, Jeff Maher. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Maher.
Jeff Maher.
Yep.
I'm sitting with the actor, Colin Price, the producer and co-writer, because you also wrote the film as well, Jeff, right? Cody Callahan. I have another producer to my left. This is Chad Archibald, who I spoke to last year, the director of Bite, and his partner in Black Fawn Films, Christopher Giroux. So, Bed of the Dead, guys. You guys are premiering tonight in Fantasia.
Yeah.
You're one of the first films to sell out. How does that feel?
That's unexpected and really, really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I was calling family here in Montreal, family in New York to come, because I literally thought it was going to be the four of us in the cinema and like our girlfriends. So I'm ecstatic. Mm-hmm. It's very exciting.
And this is your debut feature?
Yes.
So how does it feel to have your debut feature playing at a sold-out screening here in Fantasia?
It feels great. Yeah, again, I just didn't know. Like, you you work on it for so long, and, you know, we've been with the film for, I guess, over a year now.
Yeah.
And you don't even know what it is anymore. Like, is it good? Is it garbage? You can't see it anymore. You don't know what it is. So the fact that anyone likes it, and Fantasia seems to think it's worthy enough to be in the festival, means, you know, we're halfway there. So
are you pumped for tonight? Are you nervous? A bit of both?
Super pumped, super nervous. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
I'm going to have at least one or two doubles before I head into that cinema.
Chad, I have a question for you. I spoke to you around this time last year when you were bringing Bite to Fantasia, and you guys have had a number of films here at Fantasia. What does the festival mean to you?
I mean, we joke sometimes that we make movies just so we can come to Fantasia. But even with Bed of the Dead, it's been done for quite a while, but we actually saved it so that we could have a world premiere here.
Mm-hmm.
So, like Jeff was saying, it's like we've actually had the movie done and completed, and like it's just sitting on a shelf somewhere for like 6 months as we kind of prep for this. But I mean, we love it. Everyone comes down with us. I mean, it's so exciting looking on like social media right now and seeing like all the different members of the cast and crew, and they're all like driving photos of them on the 401. Like, everyone kind of gets together and it's like having a big wrap party, like a year after we've done the film. So I mean, it's a special event for us. It's so nice to see everyone again. The festival is just killer. It's, you know, my favorite festival in the world, and we've been, you know, from here to Taiwan. Like, it's definitely a special place for us. And I mean, we're honored every time we get in, and every time we actually get in, we all jump around like little schoolgirls and cheer and high five each other. And you know, it's always a challenge. You know, we're making these films at low budgets and trying to create concepts and content that's unique, that we can manage to pull off. And I mean, it's always like the first thumbs up, because it's generally the first festival we've been to. Like I sent Mitch an email every year being like, okay, so this is done and you're pretty much the first person in the world to see it. So he's always kind of like our first review.
Well, it's interesting, because back in, I would say, March of last year, I went to Hamilton to visit the butcher shop. And interviewed Carlos, and Monica was there.
Yeah.
And I believe she was actually working on something for Bed of the Dead.
Oh, cool.
Possibly, maybe not. Yeah. But anyway, but she did work on the film.
Yes.
And Carlos was showing me around, and all of a sudden he's like, you see that charred corpse there? That's for Bed of the Dead. I was like,
fucking awesome. And so when I saw the movie, I was like, oh yeah, I heard here. That's a famous Dark Horse. I saw it.
Carlos is going to be here. He's coming down.
Yeah, because the first time I heard Bed of the Dead was when Carlos mentioned Bed of the Dead.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's awesome. But the first thing that came into my head was Deathbed, the Bed That Eats.
Mm-hmm.
So is that sort of like, I mean, is that the elephant in the room? Was that inspiration for you guys?
It's funny. I hadn't heard of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But Cody and I kind of banged out a few ideas for Bed of the Dead, and then he called me and he's like, dude, there's a movie called Deathbed. And he couldn't watch it because, I don't know, you were working on Celebrity, so you got to go check this out. So I got freaked out and thought, oh, okay, we might have a problem here, because I think Breakthrough might have greenlit the film already. So I watched it, and it's very different.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But I'm a fan of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think George Barry is awesome director, and I think that the spirit of the film is similar in that he was working with low budget,
mm-hmm.
and it was sort of that do-it-yourself vibe and attitude, and Bed of the Dead kind of is similar in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting, because with Deathbed, I mean, it's sort of an obscure film.
Yeah.
A lot of people deride it because of the concept. There's a very famous bit of Patton Oswalt making fun of Deathbed.
Yeah.
It's really an amazing film. It's surreal. It's kind of like Warholian, etc.
Yeah.
And yeah, definitely Bed of the Dead, yeah. I think, is sort of along the same spirit, but sort of a different concept. So you guys co-wrote the movie together.
Yeah.
And when it came to the production and when it came to casting, how did you come about finding your actors? For example, how did you find Colin?
Well, we've worked with the same casting director for a few years now, Ashley Hallahan, and she kind of has her ear to the ground for the sort of the best talent coming up, certainly in Ontario,
mm-hmm.
and specifically non-union. She knows who's, like, she'll say, this guy's going to be the guy, so you got to meet him. And Colin, pretty much from the beginning, was the guy. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said the other day, the only problem with him is he was too good looking and he was too young. Because we wanted an older cop to play Virgil.
Right, right.
But we threw a bunch of stuff in his beard and made him wear oversized clothes and put a bunch of crap in his hair. And I think he still looked pretty good, though. But anyway, the cast, sorry to answer your question, we got everyone we wanted.
Right.
And I'm thrilled. I think they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, because even Alyssa, I think Bed of the Dead was her last non-union movie.
Yeah, before she filmed the TV show Slasher.
Yeah. So we had the opportunity to work with the one and only Alyssa King the last time. And I don't think we'll ever be able to again, because we won't be able to afford working with her.
I'm a big fan of Alyssa King, actually, yeah. They changed the title to Tormented, I believe. What was the original title of the film she was in?
I think she had just she did that right before bed, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Colin, tell me a bit about the production. How?
It was smooth. I mean, I think I had 12 or 13 days on the production, shooting. And it for me personally, it went smooth. I mean, outside of Virgil and finding his arc and, you know, exposing those flaws and troubles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could have asked for it better.
So you didn't draw on personal experience when it came to that, to Virgil's demons and whatnot?
Maybe the drinking, you know, to some extent. But I don't know how much I can say, but...
Well, as much or as little as you want.
No, it was awesome. I mean, it's my first feature film lead, and the experience has been awesome. So I'm excited to kind of see how the audience takes it tonight, and nervous at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And you're also in Late Night Double Feature, correct?
Yep.
Directed by the gentleman sitting behind you, Kelly Stewart.
Yes.
Yeah. Waving. Working. Because, I mean, it's interesting because I don't want to spoil too much of the movie, but your arc is somewhat separate from, for example, Alyssa's. I mean, it's together, but it's separate.
Yeah.
So you're working with them, but you're not with them.
It's almost like I was telling Jeff, it's almost two stories within under one kind of title until we get to the end.
Because you did No Days with Alyssa.
Yeah, I had No Days to share with the camera with Alyssa.
Yeah.
Just Hamza and
Hamza and Alex.
I mean, I don't think you shared any screen time with Alyssa or Dennis or George or any of them.
No. I mean,
A phone call.
Mm-hmm. And
but it was Cody on the other end who was playing those roles. So. Yeah.
Now, this is speculation, but I'm pretty sure, just by seeing it... Chad, did you have a cameo in the movie? Was that you at the beginning?
Yeah. There was a little casting mishap that we had last minute, and it was a pickup day that we were actually going and shooting this kind of intro to the film, and we ended up being in a field with Jeff, Cody, and me,
mm-hmm.
and Jeff's operating the camera, and we had this discussion of like, okay, well, who's going to be the bed maker? So it's going to be Cody, or it's going to be me. And unfortunately, the only wardrobe that we had was for a really big guy, and it would just look ridiculous on Cody.
I was going to say, looking at Cody right now, I don't think he would fit into those overalls. So.
And I literally, like, it got to the point where I was like, okay, and some of the wardrobe was coming with the cats, so we actually had to, like, improvise to figure out wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up with these big overalls on, these chains, and they were like, your shirt's just, we had no other shirts here. We're, like, in a shed in a field. So like, you're gonna have to lose a shirt too, and it's just like me and and I remember I was out in this field, and my sister was there as well. My sister's a little older than me, and she doesn't, you know, we film around her place sometimes, but she never really was on set.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember just looking over, and she's standing there, and she's just like, "There's my 35-year-old brother and his buddies in this field, like, this is what he does."
This is somebody what he pays you to do this. Yeah.
And they were tire chains too, weren't they? Like,
oh, yeah.
Like snow
They're
chains.
So
we just
heavy.
Threw a bunch of shit all over Chad to make it look cool, you know.
And then go walk around. I'm walking. It was like tearing hair out of my back. I was like, God, you guys.
There's an idea for, let's say, a future sequel / crossover. The Woodsman and the Groundsman together. So I kind of see that happening.
The Bed Maker and the Groundsman. Yeah. We always joke that we have like the Black Fun universe. We kind of, because we've been making these films so quickly, we've integrated a bunch of ideas in through all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have like some reoccurring characters and stuff. It's like, you know, we have Virgil Carter on this one, and then we have like the younger brother Virgil Carter. And like the Heretics, and it's like he actually played Mike Cullen as well. He's like an officer on like a lower level. It's like a street patrolman. We often do kind of crossover stuff. So maybe one day.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Ryan Barrett sharing some screen time.
Sure. The thing about those two characters, it just almost seems like they would get along well together. You know,
they'd be buddies.
Yeah. Yeah, the Bedmaker, there's nothing inherently evil about him.
Well, that's the thing, even on the day, I was like, Chad, scream when you're cutting the tree down. And then we did it for him, we looked at the footage, like, it looks awesome, but why is he screaming? Is he an angry woodsman? Like, he's not evil, the bed's evil. So but we kept it because it just looked badass. It doesn't make any sense, but Chad looks wicked.
The best is Chad's just, like, the happiest, smiliest person, so it's just, like, to see him, like,
but for some reason he hates trees.
Yeah.
Those damn trees!
Just that one tree.
Ruining the world!
He's the original, like, Lorax. Going around.
Well, at least then you got a bit of revenge on one of the trees. You got to chop it down.
So I do actually remember, though. I remember as I was doing that, I was like, the idea passed through my head that I was like, okay, now not only am I doing this, I actually thought, I'm actually going to be sitting in a theater watching this.
Yep,
with an audience in Fantasia. I'm going to be going, oh God, just waiting for it.
Well, you definitely cut a sort of an unmistakable figure. You know, I look at the credits. I was looking for your name. I didn't see it, so I guess it's on credit.
And you pulled it out.
Yeah. We could say, like, no, it's just twin.
Yeah, I think all four of us are in the movie.
Yeah.
But we didn't credit any of ourselves.
Yeah. No. We were also the cult members, like, walking.
Oh, okay.
I was a cop, and I actually have a scene in the background.
You're a cop.
He's in the
one of the
stills.
Here's the thing. I'm a murderer, so I got a thing.
The school.
Are you in this one too, Cody?
I'm a shooter.
I am. At the beginning, the guy stabbing.
Okay, you're one of the...
I'm stabby.
Stabby. Chad is stabby, and Nico, my son, is stabby. And who is Phil?
Phil Patterson
is...
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, Black Fawn, you know, you guys have been making quite a name for yourself in the world of indie horror, especially here in Canada over the last few years. And as you mentioned before, Chad, you guys are... making films at a pretty prolific pace. So what is it about Bed of the Dead that really made you say, well, this is definitely a Black Hawk film?
It's like a creative house, so we all throw ideas back and forth. So it's almost before the ideas are birthed, they're like thrown around. So it's already a Black Hawk movie even before we actually pitch it to Breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
But we all, like, I mean, you had pitched a few ideas.
Yeah.
To Breakthrough, like, you had a couple, like, this one I want to do, this one I want to do.
Yeah.
And I think your first idea,
Farrell's. I pitched an idea.
Was turned down.
Breakthrough took me out to lunch. They said, we'd love to discuss your movie idea and buy lunch and some drinks. So we went out, we had a lovely meal and a couple of beers.
Which ended with,
we love your script, but we don't want to make it. And that was the end of the lunch. I was like, okay, cool. But I got a free lunch. I got a couple of beers.
And we left there and went for a beer and calmed.
I think I went out. Yeah, I went out with these guys and they bought me drinks and said, don't worry. And I said, okay, well, there's this one really weird idea that I came up with Stephanie, the film's composer, about a bull that judges people and kills people. And then I think like 5 or 6 beers later, we had a rough idea of what the movie was about. And 2 weeks later, so we were green.
And it's funny because it was like half of it is like, so it's this bed and it kind of judges people and it was like, okay. Then he's like, and it's called the Bed of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. I see what it is.
Oh yeah. There's not the title such a thing. Okay, so I got this movie called Bed of the Dead. Everybody goes,
yeah.
All right.
I have no idea, but I have a title and a poster.
It's got like objectives, it's got this. No. Let's go back to the title. Let's talk about this Bed of the Dead.
Well, the title is fantastic. I mean, you know, it evokes many images. But yeah, I mean, when you sort of give the elevator pitch, I mean, it's a bed that judges people and kills people.
Yeah.
Some people may sort of scoff, you know. Mm. But, as they did with Deathbed.
Sure.
The Bed That Eats. But when you watch the movie, it's not tongue-in-cheek. This is a serious, malevolent bed, and it's a damn good horror film. I mean, it delivers the gore, it delivers the scares. It's really, really well done. You're fantastic in it. Colin is, the hard-bitten,
hard-nosed
Virgil. And obviously, people are responding to the idea because it's so, one of the first ones to sell out in Fantasia. So.
Yeah. Cool.
Congrats, guys. Yeah. You guys made a great film. Now, before we sign off, I wanted to ask you, what are your plans for the film post-Fantasia?
We haven't actually announced any of the next stuff that's happening, but...
it'll be announced at the screening tonight.
All right. Yeah. There's some details at the screening that we're going to announce, and then coming up, we've got some amazing festivals that they just haven't listed yet. We can't actually see them yet, but all over the world, it's doing really exciting things, and we're excited to travel around with it.
Excellent. Thank you so much, guys. Thanks for your
thank you.
Taking the time to talk to me.
Cool.
Been an absolute pleasure. And good luck with the script tonight, too.
Thanks, bro.
Cheers.
So now I'm speaking with director and writer Ian McAllister McDonald, who brought his debut feature, Some Freaks, to Fantasia Fest, which had its premiere on Sunday, July 24th. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thanks. Great to be on it.
How did the premiere go?
Great. We pulled out the show, and apparently there were 30 people turned away at the door, which was nice. I mean, when you screen something like this, which is kind of like an outsider drama, at a genre film festival, you're never entirely sure who's going to show up or how many people are going to show up. But, the movie got a lot of love from people, and, seemed to play great.
Fantastic. I was in Montreal, but unfortunately I wasn't there this past weekend. I left just a couple days before, but I did see Some Freaks. And yeah, like you said, in many ways, it's an atypical pick for a genre fest, but on the other hand, it really fits in. It's a really stunning piece of work, and I found it to be a quietly devastating picture about themes such as identity, fitting in, and it really resonated with me in a lot of ways.
Thank you. That means a lot. I think it's about all the things you just mentioned. It's weird. I kind of think of it as being a little bit of a social horror movie, and there are like kind of little nods to that throughout. Like, we actually drop references to 3 different horror movies during it. There's like, a nod to Carrie and the one of the early conversations at the high school, and then later on, the movie Freaks is being projected onto one of the walls of the park. party, and, you know, beyond that, there's a very brief clip of Deep Red playing in one of the dorm rooms and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's about kind of the horror of adolescence and, you know, the just overwhelming anxiety that, you know, surrounds that age and that time when everything is new and fresh and feels like life is built on absolute, you know, oh my God, I, you know, found someone who loves me, but oh, if they go away, will I ever find that again? You know, could this be the one and only person? And, you know, of course, it's not, that's never really the case, but, you know, at the time, that's how it feels.
And psychological horror is definitely a very apt description. You have to forgive me because I was a philosophy major in university, but in many ways it sort of reminded me of Sartre and you know, his maxim, hell is other people. And, I mean, never is that more true to us than adolescence when we're in high school. And then, you know, in many ways how we perceive others' perceptions of us and how they, you know, as far as this sort of kind of what Sartre said, how they freeze us, dictate how we see ourselves and how we interact with the world and those in it. And that's what I saw in the characters of Matt, Jill, Elmo, is that they're wrestling with not just their own self-confidence, but also their perceived perceptions of others. And some of them are able to deal with it a little bit better, some a little bit worse.
I agree. When we were talking a little bit about this at the Q&A last night, but one of the things that's interesting is the way that the way we look and the way we feel about our bodies and our personalities and ourselves in general can have a very sort of low domino effect that impacts our lives. You know, if you don't necessarily feel confident about the way you speak, you know, if you have like a high strange voice or something like that, maybe you're less likely to raise your hand during class and, you know, try to answer a question. And if that becomes a habit, then, oh, you're maybe seen as not someone who participates in class, and maybe your grades drop a little bit, and, you know, and the things that other people kind of foister onto you based on, you know, looks and personality and social standing and all that stuff, you know, it rarely does any, you know, it can feel horrible in the moment, and oftentimes it does, but, like, you know, what I'm interested in this movie is how it kind of develops people, you know, over large spans of time. You know, the movie takes place over, you know, over half a year, you know, so we're trying to get a slightly more macro view of that sort of thing.
And it's so true, because some of the emotional cruelty that's foisted upon us when we are in that environment, high school, I mean, it's basically, you know, early university, college, what have you, it's basically a fishbowl. We're just being constantly judged. I mean, that emotional cruelty leaves psychic scars, which can last well into adulthood.
Yeah, definitely. I remember one of the things that I did before we made this movie was, or actually while I was still in the script writing phase, is I just kind of went around to friends, you know, and I had my own stories, you know, about, you know, just what a nightmare adolescence was, but I went around to other friends and just kind of collected stories from people, you know, what was it like for you, what was, you know, you know, what stories do you have, and I remember talking to this one female friend of mine, and she told me a story about, you know, she was 16 or 17 or something like that. She's a very rail thin, you know, sweet, kind of bookish girl, and she was sitting in a, you know, the high school cafeteria, and suddenly this other girl ran up and, you know, kind of sat down at the table across from her, and she was all teary-eyed, and her makeup was running, and this girl was very popular, and, you know, immediately she kind of struck up a conversation with this friend of mine, you know, and started essentially unloading what an awful day she had had, and, you know, some shitty thing that her boyfriend had said to her, and, over the course of this 25-30 minute period, they began to, like, weirdly bond over, you know, just how, you know, God, you know what, sometimes life can suck, and sometimes, you know, people can be awful, and, at the end of it, the kind of more popular girl said, I'm sorry, I know this is going to sound strange, but is there any chance I could have a hug? And she's like, yeah, sure, I guess. And they, you know, she got up, and they kind of held each other, and the kind of cool girl started, like, pressing her chest into her in a weird way. And, you know, my friend's, like, pulling, you know, trying to, you know, extricate herself. And suddenly the looks at a table, you know, like 10 or 15 feet away where, you know, all of her ordinary friends sit, and goes, no, she doesn't have any. Oh. And so this was, like, literally all a ploy to see if she had developed breasts at that point. And this was, you know, and I was just thinking, I can't imagine someone who's not 18 doing something, like, I mean, or I take that back, I can, but there's something about kids that seems particularly vicious,
mm-hmm.
and especially when you are in that age group, I mean, like, it's just, like, yeah, you know, it's devastating, and this is one of the reasons why there's really not, really any adult in the movie. Marin Ireland plays Matt's older sister. But beyond that, you know, it's all, you know, young people. Because, you know, when, I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you go back to your high school and you kind of look around like years later and it's just like, wow, these kids are so tiny, you know. But, you know, when you are 17 or 18 and you look around, it's like, they seem like giants. And, you know, if you kind of pepper a movie with adults, then suddenly you're kind of contextualizing their experiences in a way that's, like, maybe factually honest, but emotionally dishonest.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Oh, for sure, yeah. And even, I'm forgetting the name of the character, Matt's sister.
Georgia.
Yeah. Georgia, yeah. I mean, she's, I guess, the lone adult parental figure, but in many ways, I mean, she's kind of a kid herself, and you know, she's a sort of single mother, making her way in the world, not really that sure of herself either. She's got a lot of, I guess, issues and demons to work out herself. So, yeah, that's something I didn't really think about until you just mentioned it, how there really is a lack of authority figures within the movie.
Yeah, there's, one of my favorite sort of coming-of-age movies is a film from 1967 called Last Summer, which, I mean, it hasn't been released on DVD or Blu-ray or anything like that, and it just kills me because it's such a, like, you know, beautiful, vicious film. It was actually nominated for an Oscar, and, like, I mean, it's just astounding, but yeah, it's like four kids, hanging out on Desert Island, or, I'm forgetting where it is. It's someplace like off the coast of Long Island, I think, for a summer. And, you know, how much mileage they get out of these, like, four young actors is just, like, crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that's kind of what we were trying to do here.
And the other thing that also resonated with me before I sort of, I really want to talk about your cast because it was spectacular, but, you know, I mean, when I was in high school, I certainly did not have an easy go of it for a lot of the same reasons that some of the characters in your film experienced. And, but one thing that kind of struck me too, I mean, as you said before, when you go back to high school and you feel, when you're in high school, you feel small, then you go back and you feel like a giant, everyone else is so small. Well, when you're in high school, you also perceive, if you're an outsider, the popular kids as having it all together. And in your film, there is a character who is, you would say, the popular kid. He's the frat boy, he's a jock, and even he's beset by insecurities and questions of identity and fear of how other people perceive him. And I thought that was a really, really deft thing to include in the film.
Thanks. Yeah, no, it's weird. Yeah, that part was played by Lachlan Buchanan, and I mean, you know, he was like far and away the hardest actor to cast. LA doesn't really have a shortage of like handsome young actors or anything like that. And you know, he brought all these people into the room who kind of looked like models, and you know, who were good actors. But the big thing that they were all missing was, you know, there was something a little smug about a lot of the performances we were seeing. And the big thing that, you know, that I needed was, like, okay, here's a character who's walking, like, you know, a really tenuous moral line. You know, he's trying, you know, he thinks of himself as, like, kind of an intellectual, and he thinks of himself as a good guy, and yet he's doing these shitty things and associating with these, you know, wretched people. You know, so there has to be some, like, inner conflict there. But for most of the people, you know, you kind of look at them and it's like, I don't think you actually feel conflicted about this, you know, and that, I mean, not the, you know, the actor wasn't able to project that sort of, you know, inner struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that, you know, that's the problem. And, you know, Lachlan walked into the room and, felt like genuinely awkward and sort of vulnerable and you know, and had all these wonderful qualities that, I mean, goddamn, like, I just assumed, like, oh, yeah, the part will cast in a day, it'll be a breeze, and, you know, it was a nightmare. Mm-hmm. For exactly the reasons that I think you're kind of alluding to.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the cast is wonderful, and I'm going to be speaking to Lily May momentarily, but, you know, with the exception of Thomas Mann, who I thought was, you know, I saw him in Me, Earl and the Dying Girl, which was another just devastatingly wonderful movie, the cast is relatively unknown, and yet everybody acquits themselves fantastically, but most importantly, everybody comes across as real, fleshed-out human beings rather than, let's say, central casting archetypes, which you would find in many, you know, quote-unquote teen movies, and that works so well to the film's favor.
Yeah, yeah. In a lot of ways, this is, like, thanks to our casting, both Lindsay Weissmuller and Nancy Mayer back in L.A. I think we had originally scheduled for, like, 3 months of casting or something like that, and we ended up going for 5 months, and, you know, they didn't charge us for the extra time, because finding people who are 20, 21, 22, whatever, you know, I think Lily was, you know, 19 when we started.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard, you know, there's a lot of young actors out there, and a lot of really good young actors, and we saw some people who were just fantastic and, you know, who had wanted to cast, but it was hard finding those people who can kind of bring a certain professionalism to the shoot, but who also have, like, kind of an unusual look to them. When we first started trying to cast the Lily's part, you know, we reached out to all the major agencies, UTA, you know, BAA, WME, all those places, and they all wrote back, every one of them wrote back and said, we don't represent a single actress that fits your physical description.
Hmm.
And it's just like, oh, fuck, wow, you know, that's sort of a kick in the teeth. But Lily, yeah, she walked into the casting room, and, you know, she's, like, funny and tough and beautiful, and, she, you know, she just, like, knocked the ball out of the park, and was also, like, just so, so brave. I mean, the movie has some rough stuff in it, and she didn't shy away from it. She was totally willing to, you know, do a deep dive into the material and, like, you know, wrestle with pretty ugly emotions, so.
And it's interesting, because as I was watching the movie, I was thinking, I was like, you know, I'm getting a little vibe, a Neil LaBute vibe, and then as I was looking at the credits, I was surprised he actually executive produced the movie.
I met Neil back in, 2006, I think. I had a short play at a theater festival, and he was, like, a guest of honor there, and at some point we started talking, and I ended up working for him as an intern for a while, and then as kind of an interim assistant. His assistant, Tim Harms, who also produced the film, is, you know, has produced a number of other movies, and so when he would go out of town to work on a film, I would kind of fill in. But, you know, we stayed in touch over the years, and, yeah, man, he was, like, everything you could ask for out of an EP. Casting Georgia was also really difficult, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of people, actors in their 30s, who honestly want to play second fiddle to a group of teenagers. And so it was kind of a tough sell. You know, Neil had worked with her on the Broadway production of Reasons to Be Pretty and passed the script along to her, and, you know, that's how he got her. But, yeah, I mean, you know, one of the bigger things he did was, you know, we did an early cut of the film, and it kind of wasn't working, which was as much my fault as anyone's. You know, I'm kind of trying to figure out how to put this thing together, and I'm a first-time filmmaker, and
mm-hmm.
and like, all the scenes are wildly evident, and the music's in the wrong place. You know, it was rough, and I called him, and I'm just like, you know, hey, what do you think? And he's just like, you know, maybe you want a fresh set of eyes to take a look at this. How about I introduce you to this editor I've been working with, you know, from the company you met? And I'm just like, you know, yeah, that would be great, but, you know, we're tapped out. We've got no money left. And so he footed the bill for that himself. So the second cut, which is, you know, in a lot of ways where we found the movie, is, I mean, you know, both creative, I mean, like, financially and feasibly because of him, you know. So, he was great.
And if, it, if any filmmaker has really explored, you know, sort of like the monstrous element of human beings and how we can act towards one another and destroy one another, both emotionally and psychically, I think it's Neil LaBute. So, perfect fit, I would say, for your material.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, In the Company of Man is still, like, one of my, you know, all-time favorites. Mm-hmm. It's, like, I can think of, like, maybe one or two other films that, like, offer such a, you know, kind of thoughtful examination of, like, the idea of evil in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that, maybe No Company of Old Men, you know, but while Anton Chigurh walks around with a gun blowing up people's heads and, you know, that weird cattle thing, you know, the Chad and In the Company of Men, you know, he's, like, got a suitcase and a tie and, you know, he's, like, seducing people and in some ways he's the more realistic character.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And I've met some Chads out there and, you know, it's terrifying when you meet them and, that for me was, like, one of the movies that made me want to make movies, so having him involved in the dream. Yeah, yeah.
For sure. Now, I don't want to impose sort of my interpretations on your film, because obviously when a filmmaker makes a film, they have a certain message to get across, and once it's out there, the viewer watches it, and they interpret and they analyze. But I mean, the title is wonderful. It's simplistic, but yet it just says so much. I mean, some freaks could refer to your principal characters, your Matt, your Jills, your Elmos, but in a way, I kind of look at, like, the macro perspective, like you were saying earlier, and I really feel think that, like, if we all examine ourselves in this society that we live in, we're all freaks.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, in high school and college, and I mean, even now, like, all my friends have kind of been, they're weird and they're strange, and like, that's what I like about them, you know. The world has a lot of very normal, buttoned-up people, and they're good, too, but, you know, I like meeting people who have something a little different about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes, whatever that thing is that makes them different, you know, it's rarely a thing that they like about themselves, is what I've noticed. Like, outsidership is difficult because frequently, you know, the very thing that kind of makes us, you know, interesting to others is a thing that stirs up a lot of self-loathing. So there's that, but, you know, at the same time, I would also say that, like, who the real freaks are in the movie is kind of up for debate. Like, I mean, the guys at the frat party, you know, when I think about, like, monsters, I think about them. So even that kind of, like, I mean, I didn't go into this movie with a thesis per se.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had literally four characters that I thought seemed kind of interesting and, like, they might bounce off one another in a fun way, or fun, disturbing, sad way. But, you know, if there was, like, one thing that I wanted people to, like, take away from this, it's not so much a message as it's just this idea that other people have been there too. You know, I kind of think that's the beauty of art and the beauty of, you know, like, horror movies, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, you watch something like, you know, The Mist, you know, which has this just, like, unremittently negative ending. And, you know, some people would say, well, you know, why on earth would you want to watch, you know, that, or, you know, Funny Games, or, you know, something
right.
that is just, like, a sucker punch to the audience, or Seven, which is one of my favorites. And it's just, like, you know, sometimes the world does feel like it's out to get you, and sometimes it feels this is a shitty place to live, and whether or not that's the whole of the truth, it definitely feels that way sometimes. And seeing a movie that reflects the way you feel, just a nice reminder that, like, you're not nuts and you're not alone in the world, and there are other people out there who've shared that experience, and I think there's a comfort in that, even if, like, the text of the comfort is despair or ugliness or whatever. And so my biggest hope is that this reaches people who have had experiences that aren't entirely different from this, because, you know, while it's not an autobiographical film, the experiences in it aren't wildly removed from mine, and, you know, I hope that alone, like, you know, reassures people.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ian, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I want to congratulate you on making an incredible debut feature. In many ways, I watched and said, well, this can't be a debut feature. It just seems so accomplished. It was just fantastic. And thank you so much for chatting with us.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for both kind words. It's been a pleasure.
So now I'm speaking with Lily Mae Harrington, who portrays Jill in Some Freaks. And Lily Mae, I was just talking with Ian, and first of all, congratulations. The film is incredible, and you're incredible in it.
Thank you so much. That means a lot. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. And I was just speaking with Ian, and we were talking about the casting process, and he was talking about calling different casting departments and whatnot, and them saying they really don't represent anybody that fits the type of character he has in mind. And then he found you. How did you and Ian come together?
You know, I actually, they found me through another agency, a very, very small agency, LS Talent Group in California. So it's a very boutique agency, but there are two women who are also full-figured and see a full-figured actress for more than just her physical landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So immediately, I commend them so much for being able to see past all these stereotypes and, you know, multiple ways with multiple different clients. So luckily there are the gems hiding in Hollywood there. So thank God for them and, helping us all connect. They pulled me into my agents and came into audition and came back a couple more times. I think our whole audition process was about, like, 2 months before I was actually cast.
Mm-hmm.
And after reading with, like, 10 different boys, even though Thomas was the first one we read with, like, 10 different guys, like, 4 different times. It was a very long process, but, for the greater good, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder what that says about Hollywood. I mean, the theme of the film, there's so many themes of the film, but of course one of them being, you know, the outsider and, you know, the social misfits and, you know, those that aren't considered to be part of the, let's say, the normative people. And then here we are in Hollywood and casting agencies don't represent fuller figured women. It kind of boggles my mind when I heard that.
Right, well, they do. They're just the girls who writers make the butt of the joke.
Mm-hmm. Not to take anything away from her, but I was just saying, like, sort of like your Melissa McCarthy type of characters, you know?
Right, and she actually has such great depth, and I can't remember, what's the movie with her and Jason Bateman?
Where she,
Identity
Thief?
Like, steals his identity and goes across. Yeah.
Identity Thief or something, yep.
She has this one moment in that movie where she is, they're eating dinner and she, like, just paid for her own makeover or whatever. She has this amazing moment in this, like, slapstick comedy, totally making fun of herself. And it's so, I remember watching it and just being so surprised and, like, wait, why can't I see her act like this in every movie?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Why can't we see this? And you know, and that's absolutely true. It's, they, you know, play to the stereotype and to the jokes about being fat and the physical comedy of that. When that was just honestly never really my life. Sure, I've always struggled with my weight, and it was always a thing that was apparent, but it was never what my growth as a person was about.
Mm-hmm.
I think many people who are white men in Hollywood, they see a bigger girl in a certain way and write it in a certain way. And without the perspective of other people, I mean, Ian is a white man from Hollywood, but he's the most sensitive soul I've ever met and empathetic soul I've ever met who, you know, is never intimidated by anyone's appearance, ever. And has even said some of the people who have the hardest shell and the scariest appearance are actually the most gentle people, which is true to a certain extent. But yeah, I hope I answered your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I would tend to agree with what you just said. It's interesting. I guess I don't want to take this interview off in a little tangent, but I'm a comic book geek. I'm a huge comic book reader, and right now in the comic scene, there's a lot of movement towards better representation of all body types. Comic books are notorious for, you know, extremely unrealistic proportions on the females and whatnot, and there's a real backlash in that sense. Whereas so now comics are starting to be more inclusive and diverse and
body types, ethnicities, etc. You know, I guess in mainstream Hollywood, they just haven't, they're still not there yet. I guess it's where the indie scene comes in.
Right. And well, and the thing is I think you're definitely right about that, and I'm happy to hear that comics are going more in that route, too, because, you know, as a girl, like you said, it's just not possible
right.
to look like some of those characters. But, yeah, I mean, I definitely think that, like we said, they're sure right now we're seeing a lot of different shapes and sizes on screen,
mm-hmm.
but they're being represented and written by people who don't represent their stories and don't necessarily empathize with their journey and their struggles. And that's why it is important that developers and writers are also of different shapes, size, and color. Slowly but surely.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we go on to my next question, I want to just very quickly for our listeners, can you describe your character, Jill, in, let's say, two or three sentences?
Sure. Jill is a very strong but lovable teenager, and she can be very quick to get angry, and she's not afraid of what other people think or the person that she's talking to, what they're worried about.
And what's interesting about Jill is that she is very strong, but at the same time, I think, like all of us, and you know what you said earlier about people who are very, you know, tough on the outward. I mean, they're wonderful on the inside. They're sweet and gentle, but you get the sense that Jill, like a lot of most of the characters in the movie, does have a lot of insecurities. I mean, she's managed to sort of make peace with her quote unquote freakishness, you know, to go with the title. But as your character progresses and goes on to college and you undergo the transformation, and there is one line that's completely devastating because I sort of went through the same transformation as your character did when I was in high school, and then all the same, are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it for other people? And there's that line that you'll never be accepted, they'll never like you anyway, and it's just, like I said, the movie is emotionally devastating, but it's really, is this a correct assumption that Jill is a character with a lot of insecurities that are sort of really pushed down as deep as they can possibly go?
Right, and yeah, and the insecurities manifest in her very outward personality and outspokenness,
mm-hmm.
I would say.
And she's a tough cookie, right, through and through, yeah.
Yeah, and which is, I mean, very similar to me, too. I'm the type of person who, when I'm nervous, I talk way too much.
Mm-hmm.
I think she definitely has a little bit of that with, it's a little tainted. It's a little sharper and, a little scarier sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about the transformation, you sort of did a reverse Robert De Niro, whereas, in Raging Bull, he went off and gained a lot of weight. Was it during production when you lost the 60 pounds?
I forgot to mention this last night. I actually ended up gaining weight first for the movie, too, and then losing some. So when I got cast afterwards, I was sat down and said, look, this is just, we think you're beautiful, we think you're lovely, and we're just wondering, how do you feel about, you know, putting on a little extra weight so that this transformation is, you know, enormous. That was hard for me to come to terms with, but
mm-hmm.
luckily I had an amazing team to help me and never had any question or worry that, like, the weight wasn't going to be lost. But I ended up, gaining, 10 pounds. And then we shot the first half, and then right when I flew back to L.A. after the first half, I, you know, went to my trainer and my nutritionist and my health coach and my doctor and, you know, my entire team. We have Derek Johnson, who was my nutritionist and new metabolism, who's amazing, and he was kind of the we had there.
And I was also saying to Ian, one thing I really like about the movie is that every principal character seems real and authentic. It's not. It doesn't seem like, you know, central casting. And although I've seen Thomas Mann before, I saw Me, Your Only Dying Girl. I thought that was an absolutely incredible movie. You know, it is a cast of, you know, relatively, I don't want to say unknown, but, you know, let's say actors that have yet to have their major breakthroughs yet. Is that is that okay to say? Or?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this was my first movie ever. But, definitely okay to say. Definitely true.
But all the same, I mean, you guys have, I'm talking about you and Thomas, and you and Eli Henry, who played Elmo. You guys have this wonderful chemistry. It comes across on screen like you've been friends for years. Did the chemistry on screen translate off screen as well?
Yeah, well, we actually all hung out a few times before we started shooting, just because we wanted to kind of create that, and definitely, I think Thomas recognized that I was a little nervous and needed like a little help and a little shove into just being more comfortable, since I kind of had to be the dominant one in most of the conversations that we have on screen. And at first that was not the case, because I was just, I was just so freaked out. It was my first movie, and this kid was like the star of a bunch of movies, and I hadn't done anything yet, and so, but I think he recognized the uncomfortability and definitely helped. And me, him, and Eli went out a few times. I remember one of the first nights we hung out, we played Heads Up, that game, that app.
Yeah.
We played Heads Up.
Haven't played it, but I know of it. Yeah.
Yeah. That broke the ice.
Nice. What was the premiere like at Fantasia for you?
Sorry, say that again?
What was the premiere like at Fantasia for you?
Oh, it was, amazing and very overwhelming. It went by so fast. Like, I was watching the movie, and then I realized, like, in the last scene, oh my gosh, it's the last scene. I can't believe we watched the entire movie. Like, it just, it was a total blur. My mom and my sister are here, so... And they hadn't really seen the movie, so that was also very exciting, and also, you know, one of the most important opinions in my life. Like, Mom, did you like it? it was great. It was really, really great, and a lot of the producers and other actors are here, so it's definitely a family affair. Yeah, very close-knit group of people.
And Fantasia, I was there. Unfortunately, I left before your film premiere, but it's just a wonderful audience, a wonderful atmosphere.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. And everyone in the room especially after the Q&A, like, we had almost the entire room stay, which was so cool. And everyone was just so intently listening, and it felt amazing that people want to know about this movie, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, before I let you go, I have to ask you one more question. We're going to be sort of moving away from some freaks right now. But I, you know, having you on the phone, I would be totally remiss if I didn't ask you this question. Because you worked with one of my absolute heroes. I mean, he was a hero of mine from the time I was a young child. He's still a hero of mine. I think you know what I'm talking about. Paul Rubens?
Oh, yeah. Oh my goodness.
You were in Pee-wee's,
amazing.
You were in Pee-wee's Big Holiday, and I was gonna ask you, what was it like working with the great Paul Rubens?
Like, truly awesome. Like, everything and more than I expected it to be. At first, like, he was in the room at the callback, so and again, like, being a little actress in a room just get so nervous, even though you're not supposed to, but with Paul Rubens, I was nervous because I grew up watching Pee Wee's Playhouse, and every Christmas, me and my family still watch Pee Wee's Christmas Special. Mm-hmm. So it was like something that was like very close to home. I was like, oh my gosh, I really hope I get this, like, at any part in this. I just want to be in this movie. And so he was so wonderful in the room and made me feel so comfortable, and I think he really liked my vibe too, because he had me read for another character, I think, but he just wanted to see me act more and be in the room for a little longer, which felt really great. And then on set, that whole sequence of the farmer's daughters was about a week to shoot. And so we got to be on set for a week with Paul Rubens every day, and he was just so great. He knew everyone's name on set. He gets everybody's birthdays and sends them everybody a card on their birthday. Like this last birthday, I got like an amazing e-card email from Paul Rubens, which was like so cool.
I'm kind of getting goosebumps when you say that.
What's that?
I said I'm getting goosebumps when you say that. Getting a card from Paul Rubens, yeah.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, he was just so rad. I loved him.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
It's, yeah, I mean, the farmer's daughter scene is amazing. The whole movie, what a wonderful return to form. Not return to form, but it's like he never went away. I mean, and every time I'm feeling just a little bit down, I just, you know, turn on Netflix and just cue up that balloon scene, and that's all it takes.
Oh, my gosh, I know, right? And, like, I can't even say his last name, which is the joke of the movie, but Joe Manganiello, Manganiello. Such a great addition to that movie.
Indeed, oh yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, and like that movie on, you know, reading the script was hilarious, but just seeing it all was even more hilarious and so awesome. And I'm so happy to be a part of that movie.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, Lily May, and
thanks, Jeff.
I want to also congratulate you on Some Freaks, because the film as a whole is incredible, and it wouldn't be as successful as it is without your amazing performance. So, congrats.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much.
Well, thanks once again, and have a wonderful day.
Yeah, you too. Peace out.
Thank you.